And we'll resume with Mr. Baldino.
So I just wanted to begin with a respectful request for 2 minutes of rebuttal, should it prove appropriate.
I'm sorry that Amicus doesn't get rebuttal.
Okay.
Please, we'll welcome your argument now.
Sure, sure. So the issues that we're here as Amicus on behalf of the NJEA to address are pretty discreet and narrow, but we view them as important because there was this whole analysis, as the court was discussing, regarding primary versus secondary ultra vires doctrine, which wasn't addressed below and which we think makes a very important and decisive difference here. And before even getting into it, because there was so much colloquy on this in the prior argument, I just think it is worth addressing that it seems clear from my review of the record that there was a reasonably debatable statute here. And we know that because the agency below promised the petitioner that he would receive this free health insurance. And it appears that the issue as it was presented below and it's discussed in the record was whether this service could be in the terminology front-loaded, whether after the purchase it could be awarded nunc pro tunc and be considered service that was rendered prior to that 2011 cutoff date.
Are you telling us that the July 27th, 2015 letter makes the language of the statute reasonably debatable?
The July 15th
letter from the Division of Pensions and Benefits?
What I'm saying is that the statute discusses the requirement that the person have creditable service in the terminology prior to the enactment of Chapter 78.
Indeed. So let's focus on the statute then.
And I believe it is debatable. And we see it as debatable simply because the language is not clear. It doesn't address how a purchase of service credit would be addressed in that situation. And I haven't seen in the arguments of the state anything to address that legal issue. There was a footnote in their supplemental brief which discussed issues that I don't really believe were on point, such as how service credit is calculated at the time it's made, or whether a purchase of service credit could be done after retirement. But in terms of whether the purchase of service credit could be considered nunc pro tunc, or as it's discussed in the record, and as the agency apparently discussed it when it promised this to Mr. Myers, was whether it could be front-loaded or considered credited prior to 2011, because the actual service was performed prior to 2011.
Your reference the second time now to the agency making a promise. That's to the computer-generated letter that went out?
I believe there were other promises discussed in the letter that the state advised Mr. Myers that he would receive free health benefits.
Right. So we have the letter. I was just asking, this is the only thing that you're relying on when you refer to the agency having made a determination that he was eligible?
I can't speak to whether that's the only thing I rely on. I recall that there was discussion that Mr. Myers had received those promises, certainly from his HR department and from the agency.
Fair enough.
Yes.
So the statute appears to impose a blanket rule. It does not say there are no exceptions or anything like that, but the plain language of the statute, 28 DB3, how is that unclear?
Well, I believe it's at least reasonably debatable as to how a purchase of service credit would be treated, because it talks about the requirement that the person have 20 years of creditable service as of the enactment of the act, which was in 2011. And granted, it's understood that this purchase could not have been done until 2013 when it was permitted under the law, but it was at least ambiguous and reasonably debatable to the point where the mistake was actually made, not just us to Mr. Myers, but several other state troopers. And I think that gets into the whole point about primary versus secondary jurisdiction, which is that in all of these cases, you're talking about a situation where the agency apparently violated a statutory requirement. That's the premise. If we're talking about equitable estoppel and whether it's secondary versus primary jurisdiction, every one of those cases involved a situation where the agency didn't follow the statutory requirement, and yet the the member, the beneficiary, was ultimately entitled at equity to receive the benefit because of the equities of the situation, because they had been induced to rely on the agency's promises, because they had been harmed by them.
Is there a violation that you're alleging here of the statute?
Because we're in the equitable estoppel box and we're talking about primary versus secondary jurisdiction, I'm assuming we're already talking about a situation where the statute apparently didn't permit this. Now, I don't know if that's true. There wasn't enough really discussed about the purchase of service credit issue and how it should be treated. But going to the equitable estoppel issue, every one of those cases involved a situation where the agency did not follow a statute. And the question was, did they exceed their authority in a manner that was wholly outside of their jurisdiction, meaning was it a primary ultra vires or was it secondary ultra vires? And the distinction is not always so easy to draw, but I think what it really goes to is whether, I mean, so first of all, one of the first things that's looked at is whether there was a reasonably debatable interpretation of the statute on the part of the agency. And again, we would submit that it was reasonably debatable here, because you could argue, and it appears that that was what the way it was viewed, that the service could be front-loaded or treated as awarded nunk-pro-tunk because the service had been performed. The military service was performed prior to 2011. But even in cases, I would submit, where the statute clearly could not have permitted the person to be eligible, meaning there was no way, it wasn't even reasonably debatable, there has still been an extension of equity. So a good example of that would be the Giuliano case, which we cited in our papers, where you had a police chief who was hired over the maximum age limit. And there was no way, there was nothing that chief could have done to render themselves eligible under the statute. But under the equities, it was considered, maybe they were 1 year too old under the maximum age limit, it was considered too inequitable for that person to forfeit their position because of a mistake of their employer, which the employer was really supposed to be the one to be looking out for that. It's unfair to penalize the person who was hired under the premise that their employer satisfied all the legal requirements. Another good example is the Skolsky v. Nolan case, which we cite. I think it's very interesting that if you look closely at that case, while the case does discuss the issue of analyzing, there were some 55 disability pensions that were being reviewed as to whether they had been lawfully awarded, and I think there was a connection to corruption. But the actual pensioners had applied for their benefits in good faith and believed they were entitled to them, and they were receiving those pensions from anywhere from 2 to 27 years out. And the court said, before you even get into whether the disability pension was awarded under a reasonably debatable premise, first look at whether it would be equitable to even reopen their case. So sometimes the equity even trumps whether the statute is clear or not. Although again, I think the statute was at least ambiguous here. And then again, you know, going back to these cases, quite simply, Wood and Middletown are the two most relevant ones because they also involve purchases of service credit, and they also involve questions of free health insurance in retirement. The state has argued that, well, what distinguishes those cases is that all of those people could have remained in service. They could have completed 25 years of service. That was the requirement that the town had to follow in order to grant them free health insurance. And they didn't. And here, Mr. Myers, there's no way, there was nothing in his power that he could have done to satisfy the eligibility criteria. But I don't think that's actually what the law says. I don't think it was what their analysis rested on in Wood and Middletown. We know that from a number of other cases that look at this analysis. The two I just mentioned were the Skolsky case and the Giuliano case. Also, the original case that starts it all, the Summer Cottagers case, that involved whether a sale should be invalidated due to the failure to provide the mandatory notice requirements. So clearly, it goes beyond simply whether the person could have been eligible or not. It really goes to, it's this aspect of the analysis in a governmental equitable estoppel case that analyzes the government's actions. It's not about the recipient of benefits so much as it is whether this is such an extreme or such a wholly outside of the powers of the agency exercise of power as to be impossible to permit equity as a form of relief, or whether it is more in the vein of a technical violation, whether the harm to the state interest is slight and the harm to the person who has been inequitably induced to rely would be much greater. And I would submit we do have such a harm here. Mr. Myers, he made a purchase using $94,000 of savings. He left a job that he apparently loved. It was his dream job. It was what he always wanted to do with his life. He retired early. None of that would have happened if he had not been told that he would have received free health insurance in retirement.
How can you make that representation?
Well, that's what the ALJ found below. The ALJ accepted the testimony of Mr. Myers.
But didn't the agency then find that there was no, there was not substantial evidence to support that, and they specifically reversed that factual finding?
Well, yes, I understand that there's this troubling analysis that went on of second-guessing the ALJ's findings, mostly based on Mr. Myers doing better for himself after retirement, which I would respectfully submit is a misplaced focus. That, you know, whether Mr. Myers, after he was wrongly told that if he purchased his service for $94,000, would receive health insurance, if he then walked out after retirement and he collected a winning lottery ticket or some other good fortune befell him.
That's not what happened in this case, but specifically when it comes to the SHBC, they found, I understood, that the ALJ's factual findings were not supported by sufficient, competent, and credible evidence in the record and were unreasonable. And you're saying that that was disturbing, but I'm not sure why. Isn't that the role of the agency? The agency does have the authority to review the credibility determinations and the factual findings of the ALJ. And if they find that they're not supported by sufficient, competent, and credible evidence in the record, then they can disregard them. Are you saying that the standard of review should somehow be different? What is the exact disagreement?
No, I'm not arguing against the standard of review, but suggesting that the focus in the equitable estoppel analysis was legally wrong for focusing on the wrong type of harm done by to the recipient. The harm here was the inducement to purchase for $94,000, which I think was...
But he needed to purchase those credits in order to be able to retire 4 years early. And he was able to retire 4 years early. And he did get this large, I think it was $7,000 a month retirement payment. Plus, he had already been working for this firearms manufacturer before he retired at a large salary. And so that continued afterwards, all as part of a plan. So he needed to buy the service credits, not to get the health benefits, but to be able to retire 4 years early, which he was able to do, correct?
That's absolutely correct, that he purchased the service credits to retire early, retiring early on the premise that he would do so receiving free health insurance.
How, I think Justice Patterson's question was, when the evidence in the record is he retired early to be able to collect this $7,000 a month retirement benefit after that, I think it was 65% of his previous pay, plus a large salary from a firearms manufacturer that he already had the job with before he retired. Where is the evidence that he only retired early in order to get free health benefits and that the $800 a month was really the only issue rather than the $7,000 a month retirement benefit?
So what I'm saying is that Mr. Myers' testimony before the ALJ was accepted, that he did...
It wasn't accepted. The agency said that it was not accepting those factual findings and that instead it found that there was not sufficient evidence to support them and it was therefore finding that they were unreasonable.
Yes, Your Honor. My understanding of the record, and I'm if I'm wrong, then, you know, I'm doing my best with my memory, but that the ALJ then sent it to the Health Commission, who reviewed it and reversed the ALJ's findings. But the ALJ had accepted that this reliance did occur and that the reason for the early retirement and the purchase of service credit was because of this promise of free health insurance, and that otherwise Mr. Myers would have stayed in employment, and that means he wouldn't have made the $94,000 purchase, which was a lot. That was, I believe, from his testimony, was a lot of his savings, most of his savings. Also, he didn't stay longer and receive a better retirement benefit, which he would have. So accepting the record as it is and the findings of fact by the ALJ.
So you're saying that we have to find facts as found by the ALJ, not as found as the found by the agency, even though the agency specifically held that the ALJ's factual findings were not supported by substantial credible evidence and therefore had to be disregarded.
Well, one of the things that the agency also said was that there had been no intentional misrepresentation, and that's the equitable estoppel is not limited to situations where an agency intentionally misrepresents the situation. That would be far too narrow. And so review that in terms of reviewing the agency decision, that would be done under the arbitrary and capricious standard. We haven't gotten to that point yet because the appellate division has held that no equitable estoppel analysis can apply at all. From my review, I believe the agency got it wrong, yes, especially considering that they held intentional misrepresentation was required. And in counting his post-retirement employment against him, I don't believe as a legal matter that would be correct, because what was undisputed was paying over the $94,000, which is a lot of money, especially for Mr. Meyer, leaving a job early that he otherwise, it was accepted in the testimony by the ALJ, he would not have done so otherwise. He loved his job, and that is the harm.
But his post-retirement income from the pension, from the other employment, and the benefits that he had is all relevant to the ultimate issue that was before the agency at that time, and that is the reason for his decision. I mean, you're telling us the reason for his decision was the health benefits, but the other benefits of his decision, to use the term generally, are certainly relevant to that determination.
Absolutely, everything is relevant in an equitable analysis, but I think that, I mean, firstly, we didn't get to equitable analysis. The appellate division dismissed it, said it couldn't occur, which we know is not true under this doctrine of primary and secondary ultra vires case law. But I certainly do believe from what I saw from the agency's decision that they got the analysis wrong, certainly by requiring intentional misrepresentation. In terms of whether they had authority to overrule the ALJ's findings, that there was a harm caused to Mr. Myers, that would need to be properly briefed and reviewed. It hasn't been done yet, but I think it's indisputable that the toothpaste can't be put back in the tube. The $94,000 can't be given back to Mr. Myers. He can't go back into service because he doesn't have his certification anymore as a police officer. And the ALJ accepted that he did all of that.
And you're making the argument that the agency did not have the authority to overturn those findings.
They did, but they had to have the correct reasons. The reasons that I saw were that there was no intentional misrepresentation against him, which is not the correct legal analysis. And also to discount the finding that he had been harmed merely because he was earning money in retirement.
I think we have your position on those issues. Is there anything else you'd like to add before we...
Only just that, you know, it's not unusual in the pension law to allow for equity to provide relief where a statutory requirement isn't fulfilled. And there's another case like that, the Bernstein case cited in our brief for substantial compliance. There's a whole range of other cases. And so it's not It's not the case that equitable relief would be foreclosed simply because a statutory requirement isn't met. And that's the problem here. That's why we wanted to submit an amicus, because that analysis has not been performed by the Appellate Division, and we feel that it should have.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Harris.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. As part of its major overhaul of the state's public pension system in 2011, the legislature significantly reformed the way health benefits are funded for public employees and retirees. For the first time, it required all retirees to contribute to their health benefits premiums. The only people exempt are employees who had 20 or more years of creditable service as of June 28, 2011. In other words, the legislature created, as of that date, a closed class of individuals who could qualify for free health benefits in retirement. James Myers had 17 years of creditable service as of June 28, 2011, so he did not belong to that closed class of grandfathered employees, and there was nothing he could ever do that would make him part of the class. Under these circumstances, the Appellate Division correctly found that equitable estoppel could not apply. This court has long recognized that it is only in extremely rare and very compelling circumstances that equitable estoppel may be invoked against the government, and for good reason. As this court observed in County of Morris versus Fauver, matters of public interest and legislative will should not be easily compromised by freely applying the doctrine of estoppel to irregular governmental conduct. So this court will invoke estoppel against the government only where doing so would not hinder or prejudice essential governmental functions and where it doesn't implicate areas outside of the entity's authority. In other words, the court looks to see whether the governmental entity acted completely outside of its authority. In those cases, equitable estoppel cannot be invoked. On the other hand, where the entity irregularly exercised a basic power under the legislative grant, traditional equitable estoppel considerations may be considered. This case falls squarely within the first type of situation where equitable estoppel does not apply. Because he did not have 20 years of creditable service as of June 28, 2011, Mr. Myers was precluded by the statute from ever receiving free health benefits in retirement. And neither the State Health Benefits Commission nor the Division of Pensions had any authority to thwart the legislative will and add Mr. Myers to that closed class that was grandfathered under the statute. But even if equitable estoppel could be considered, Mr. Myers failed to show detrimental reliance. When he put in his retirement papers, he was told that he would receive free health benefits. But that information, even if it played a role in his decision to retire, did not detrimentally affect his eligibility for these benefits. Had he not retired and worked until he reached mandatory retirement in 2024, he still would not be eligible for the benefits. His ineligibility for free health benefits was not due to anything the state agencies did. It was set in stone years earlier when the legislature enacted Chapter 78. Mr. Myers also testified that he suffered because he gave up a job he loved based in part on his belief he would receive free health benefits. But no matter how much he enjoyed working for the state police, he still made the decision in 2015 to take early retirement because financially that was the best decision for him and his family. And those considerations still pertain, even though he has to contribute to his health premiums. His pension, combined with his income from his second career, still exceed his state salary. And his purchase of military credit was also a financial benefit to him. It enabled him to retire 4 years earlier, which means that over the course of his lifetime, he receives an additional 4 years of pension benefits. It also allowed him to retire with a special retirement benefit of 65% of his state police salary at 21 years rather than 25 years of service. In short, the commission did not have authority to grant Mr. Myers the remedy he seeks. And even if it did, there was no detrimental reliance, and there was no compelling circumstances that would warrant application of equitable estoppel. For all of these reasons, the Appellate Division's decision should be affirmed. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Ms. Ahrens, I'm looking at the letter from Pensions to Mr. Myers, the July 27, 2015 letter that says, quote, there is no premium cost to you for these various health plans. How many letters of this sort went out by Pensions to individuals that were flat out wrong?
So That is not in the record, but I did make an inquiry because I imagine this court would be interested. And from what I understand, it was 16.
And it is deeply troubling.
Yes.
That someone would get a promise like that, then make a decision to retire, and then be told, notwithstanding this misrepresentation, there's no remedy at all for you. Is there any remedy under these circumstances?
Certainly, there's no remedy in terms of, I mean, the remedy he wants, which is to get free health benefits for the rest of his life, is not available. The remedy that the commission fashioned was to not recoup the money that it had paid him, and it applied equity there to not recoup the overpayment. But other than that, I don't know any other remedy. I mean, certainly everyone is quite upset about this. It was a mistake that somebody who was coding the computer system miscoded it, and
And it affected 16 total people, you said?
Yeah, it wasn't. Yes, it is. From what we know, it was 16 people. That was what I've been told.
So that's the universe of retirees that are in the same or similarly situated as Mr. Myers?
They're not all. So they didn't all purchase military credit. I mean, there were other situations. Some of them were purchasing other credit after Chapter 78 was enacted, as I understand it. But they were all, and it was all state police. It was a problem with the state police retirement system, from what I can tell. I haven't heard about it being a problem in any of the other retirement systems.
Did they all get the same relief that Mr. Myers got? Free coverage?
I believe so. I don't want to misstate, but that is my understanding, that they all were told they did not have to repay the benefits.
Was the nature of the error each time due to the 2013 statute being enacted and the purchase of those service credits?
I don't think so, because I'm aware of one other case, that at least one case where it was the individual had purchased, he had been in PIFRs or PERS prior, and he had purchased that credit after Chapter 78 was enacted. So I think it was a coding error in implementing Chapter 78, but I don't know for sure. I mean, I don't want to, again, misstate.
I have a follow-up question. Are you familiar with any provision that would assist in determining whether or not there's any retroactivity considered for the purchase of service credits?
There isn't. So if you look at the statutes, creditable service is defined in 53:5A-3 as service rendered for which credit is allowed on the basis of contributions made by the member or the state. And then if you go to 53:5A-6, it says service as a full-time commissioned officer, non-commissioned officer, et cetera, rendered as a member, and service credit which was transferred shall, if the required contributions are made by the state and the member, be considered as creditable service. And then it talks later about purchasing. That's in 53:5A-6A. And then in 53:5A-6B, it talks about purchasing credit from another retirement system. And it says that they can be permitted to purchase it if such purchase service credit or transferred purchase credit is established, it shall be considered as creditable service. And then Chapter 87 has similar language. Once it's purchased, it's considered creditable service. So creditable service is you working for an employer for which your service is credited in the pension system, as long as you make the payment and the state's making the payment. Purchase service is a different animal, so it's considered as creditable service, but only after it's purchased. And Chapter 78 is very clear. You have to have 20 years of creditable service as of June 28, 2011. So I don't really think there's a real question about, the front loading or whatever. It's creditable once it's paid.
What about the language in 6.1 that counsel was arguing to us? Can you tell us your understanding?
Yeah, sure. So they're pointing to the part that says, notwithstanding any provision of this act to the contrary, a member shall not be liable for any costs associated with the financing of pension adjustment benefits and health care benefits for retirees when purchasing credit for military service. That paragraph is in all of the credit purchase statutes in the pension system. Every pension system allows for purchase of pension credit. And what it's talking about is that when they are making an actuarial calculation, when you go in to purchase credit and they have to make an actuarial calculation based on your age and your salary and whatever other factors, they're not supposed to consider the payment of potential retirement benefits and how much the state might have to pay for retirement benefits in the future or potential COLAs. And in fact, we don't have COLAs anymore because Chapter 78 did away with those also for retirees. But the legislative history kind of mentions that in passing. It says, the bill also provides that the purchase cost to the member does not include any costs associated with the cost of living adjustment. Since the payment of a COLA has been suspended by Chapter 78, it is not currently a cost factor associated with this bill. That's all that means. It would be anomalous to suggest, I think their reading of it is that you could purchase a month of military credit and thereby get around Chapter 78 because you'd never have to pay for your health benefits ever again. And that just makes no sense.
That would only be for somebody who retired at 19 years and 11 months right before the effective date. Right? If they're only purchasing 1 month, it would carry them to 20 years.
Right. No, what I mean is if I think their argument about this language that maybe I don't understand the argument, but I thought that they were citing this paragraph to suggest that Chapter 87 kind of undoes what Chapter 78 does. That sort of is because it mentions healthcare benefits, it means that if you purchase military time, it somehow means Chapter 78 doesn't apply, and that would be anomalous because that would you could literally purchase a month or a year of military time, and have it apply, and then somehow you're going to get free health benefits. I mean, it means that it has to do with the calculation. It says the financing of pension adjustment benefits. It has nothing to do with, your entitlement to any kind of health benefits in the future.
Very quickly.
Yes.
They say that the agency decision was arbitrary and capricious because the agency required the trooper to show intentional misrepresentation. Am I right about that?
The agency mentioned that in its final decision, but that was not really the basis of the final decision. It mentions it kind of in passing.
So there's no requirement, obviously, that he show intentional misrepresentation.
No,
in fact, there was not. It was a mistake.
It was a mistake.
Questions, anyone? Anything else you'd like to add?
Just that for all these reasons, the Appellate Division's decision should be affirmed.
Thank you. Thank you to all counsel. We'll take the matter under advice.